This podcast is an unscripted, unedited conversation about true crime. We take the cases very seriously, but I don't take myself seriously at all, and neither should you. Welcome to Wife of Crime.
So, Russ, we all know that you can't stand wrongful conviction cases, and I understand why. They make you incredibly angry. The case I have for you today is going to hit really close to home because it happened right here in the Boogie Down Bronx. A 16-year-old kid would be convicted of a murder he never committed and then spend the next 30 years fighting to prove his innocence. This is the case of Hugh Burton. Everyone, welcome back to Wife of Crime, a true crime podcast where I tell my husband Russ true crime stories and he reacts to them.
So, folks, it's your boy Russ, aka the Bronx's finest profiler, aka vote for Russ, aka stay fit, stay alive, even though my stomach's a little jiggly right now.
You went from having one aka, now you have like four per episode.
I think what happens is I don't come in with any of them really, just the random scrambledness in my brain
just comes out
in AKAs.
Okay. And I'm Jess, and we're back for another week.
What I kind of wanted to talk about is, I know you'll have the details. I didn't have the details because I just look at the headlines.
Mm-hmm.
I fill in the blanks. There was a podcaster that was stalked.
Yeah.
And killed by a listener.
Yeah, he stalked her for months.
Wow.
And then he showed up to their house, her and her husband's house, and he murdered them.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. The amount of people who sent me that article, but then along the message, like we had so many messages from listeners that sent that article, but then underneath the article, the message that they sent was like, I came across this, but I knew it wasn't you guys because Russ would have given them that smoke.
Maybe the story the other way around is podcasters stalked by creep. Creep found dead.
Exactly. But no, honestly, all seriousness though, that is scary. And I feel really bad for those people. Like, you know, we get on here, we talk to each other on microphones, we put it out for the world to see. We're very honest about our life. Like, we don't hold anything back at all. I feel like we talk about everything on this podcast, and even, so many people know our personal stuff.
Yeah, even like you don't want me to. You're like, why'd you tell him that?
That's true. But like, we really put ourselves out there, and a lot of hosts do that, and that's so scary and sad to think about the fact that they were stalked and then murdered. And it's terrifying. I feel so bad.
Should I even have a family member that says I talk too much about our personal life? She's like, you two talk too much about our family life. But hey.
Well.
We're here. I'm not really hard to find necessarily.
No, you're not.
Like.
You're not hard to find because the name Russell is like such an old name. I feel like there's not a lot of guys your age with the name Russell.
But just like even my social media isn't private, and I shouldn't say that, but like,
yeah,
whatever. If you find me, you're gonna be bored. I ain't doing nothing. I'm going to work. I'm annoyed. You know, what are you looking for? Instead of an old, like a grumpy old man, you're just gonna find a grumpy young man.
That's funny. Well, I feel really bad for those people, and it was terrifying.
That is, did the guy get caught?
So it's actually really nuts. What happened was he was a listener of her podcast and he started messaging her on social media, like going back and forth. And like we do with our listeners, we'll message them, we'll have little short conversations, stuff like that. So they were having these conversations, but then the conversations became a little too weird to her.
I wonder what if they were.
He kept messaging nonstop. So she disengaged and she stopped answering.
Yeah.
And then he ended up, he drove from Texas to Washington State to her house. He broke in at 2 a.m. into their house. And she had already contacted the police prior to this and said that this guy's messages were getting really weird and she was getting scared. They installed Ring cameras around their house and he ended up breaking in at 2 a.m. and shot her husband and shot her.
Wow.
And so he's in custody now.
Do you know what the podcast was called?
I don't know what the podcast was called, but I think it was a financial podcast.
Well, I wonder if it was popular or just like a small pod that he just latched onto.
Yeah, I don't know, but he was messaging her a lot and scaring her, like totally stalking her. The whole story was terrifying, and I feel really bad for their family. And, you know, it is scary being a podcast host. We put ourselves out there a lot, and it could happen to anybody, clearly.
It's kind of a risk you take.
It is, yeah.
I never realized how much you interact with people. I thought that, like, it would just be out there, and people either listen or they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the extent of it.
Yeah, but it turns out when you host a podcast, you interact with people a lot.
Yeah, we kind of have like a community of people like we talk to a lot.
Yeah, I talk to them a lot. And we all message each other. You message people on yours and our On the Wife of Crime one. Like, we message people a lot. And it's like almost become like a thing where we've built this community. And I think of them as people I really know in real life. And I've never met you guys.
Yeah.
So weird.
I just look at it as like a group of weirdos that we found our home. So shout out to you weirdos that stick around.
So we covered the documentary Don't Pick Up the Phone this month on our Patreon. And it was a pretty interesting conversation. And, you know, we got some interesting responses. Some people completely agreed with Russ. Some people agreed with me. Me and Russ actually agreed on some things.
When?
So if we did. So
I think once in like 2015 we agreed on one thing.
Well, it's been a while. In this coverage of the documentary, we agreed on a few things. So if you guys want to check out our review of the Netflix documentary Don't Pick Up the Phone, head over to Patreon. And there's a bunch of other episodes over there because we do a true crime and chill every month where we watch a true crime documentary and talk about it. So you have loads of episodes over there. As Russ would say, you have an ass ton of episodes over there to check out.
That's a ton of ass, boy.
And you have the patron shout outs, so.
Yeah, I do. So these are the people that joined Patreon this week. So it's Ashley, Willow, Tony, Gabby, Cody, Anne, Megan, Kiani, Paige, Melissa, Faith, Katie, Rachel, Ashley, and Anna. So cheers to you guys.
Cheers to you guys.
And as you guys know, every week I do review of the week. And this one is from... Oh, yeah, so go rate us 5 stars, too. If you're going to rate us 4, don't. Just, like, don't write nothing and move on, bro. This review is from Mrs. Corbett Potter. Short and sweet 5 stars. Here's the breakdown. Jess is sweet, loves true crime, has genuine empathy, and thinks her husband is simultaneously hilarious and problematic.
Mm-hmm.
LOL. She's what brings you here, but Russ is what keeps you coming back. He says what we are all thinking, but in the thickest NYC accent. Truth is, I love them both, but for a different reason, and you will too.
Aww.
So, I guess that's fair, you know, like, Jess always wants me to not say stuff, but...
Well, I posted that on our Instagram, that review. I posted it this week because when I read it, I was like, oh my God, this is such a good way to look at the pod.
I think
you're hilarious, and sometimes your opinions can be potentially problematic.
You see, that's the problem with marriage, right? Like, you can be hilarious, but your opinions aren't welcome if you have a wife. You're not allowed to have opinions unless it's the same opinion she has. And if it's not the same opinion she has, she's going to convince you why you're wrong and you should have her opinion. And then you just say, okay. So they shut up, even though you don't believe it. But Jess doesn't shut up because she knows and she keeps going.
Well.
Hashtag save Russ.
Whatever. Well, I thought that was such a good review. So thank you so much, everybody, for all the amazing reviews. We get so many great reviews and they always encourage us. I love them. So I put a poll on Patreon a few weeks ago and I gave them a choice for the next couple episodes. A serial killer case won the poll. So that's what I covered last week. The case of the Cook brothers, which were serial killing siblings, which is still insane to me. It's a totally insane nuts case. If you haven't listened, go listen to it. The episode is titled, Oh Brother. Well, the runner up on the poll that I posted was wrongful conviction case. Now, I know you don't like them because they make you angry. And I feel you, Russ, honestly.
Yeah, it's usually just like a cop or a prosecutor just trying to get the victory. And I hate that shit.
Well, I get incredibly angry as well. But I think wrongful conviction cases and exoneration cases are not covered enough by true crime podcasts. So I will always have them in rotation. I want their stories told. These stories are so important to tell because many of these people lost so much and so many of them are just forgotten. Like they do their time or they go to jail and then everyone forgets about them. And I won't let that happen. As long as I have a true crime podcast, I'm telling these stories.
How long are you going to have a true crime podcast?
Forever. You genuinely laughed at me.
I was thinking, you like the Puff Daddy of this shit. Can't stop, won't stop.
I was going with Sandlot, but yes, Puff Daddy as well.
Well, if you Puff Daddy, that means I'm Biggie because you discovered me on the for the podcast.
That's true.
I'm the Biggie Smalls of this shit. Baby, baby.
So I'm someone, as Russ will tell you, who really wants to be understood and believed.
Lord,
and
help us all.
It's definitely a flaw of mine sometimes, but looking back, I definitely should have been a lawyer.
Oh, you're the best arguer.
But as I was researching the case this week, I realized why these cases matter to me so much. Because I put myself in their shoes, and the idea that someone could be innocent and telling the truth and no one believes them and it causes their entire life to be ruined by this horrible system, it just affects me so much. So I have some stats for you, okay?
I like stats because they're usually factual.
Yes. New York City has the third highest rate of wrongful convictions in the nation. And currently, if you are wrongfully convicted of a crime, New York State law does not allow you, as the convict, to petition the court for post-conviction relief if there's DNA evidence that emerges. So say you get falsely accused of a crime, you get put in jail for a crime you didn't commit, and then later down the line, DNA comes out from that crime. You, as a convict, can't petition the court to have the DNA tested.
Why don't they want innocent people free? Are they trying to keep like a high conviction rate?
Talk to New York State, bruh. I don't know.
I'm going to hit up New York because I'm New York.
New York is also just one of five states in the U.S. that does not provide the right to an attorney in post-conviction cases, which means prisoners who want to prove innocence have to either hire an attorney.
Which beg, you don't got the money.
Exactly. Beg one to take their case pro bono, or beg the Innocence Project to take their case. Like, write the Innocence Project about their case, and hopefully they'll take it on.
And the chances of them taking your case on are probably very slim, because imagine how many people write into them.
I'm sure,
they probably don't even get to read all the letters.
Yeah, so many people.
Or emails now.
50% of exonerees are Black, despite only making up 13% of the U.S. population.
Oh, that's what I was going to ask. What percentage of the population are they?
13.
That's it? You know, living in New York, I almost feel like Black people's like half the people. Because like,
well, living in New York, you're a melting pot. We have a melting pot here of many cultures.
Or maybe not. Maybe if I had to guess, maybe it feels like 40% in my mind.
Well, it's just also because of where you grew up. More than $1.5 billion of New York taxpayers' money has been spent on settlements for claims of police misconduct. $1.5 billion of taxpayer money has been sent settling cases of police misconduct.
But is that forever?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
That's a lot of money.
Billions, and even millions. I wish someone would misconduct me a little bit and give me some change.
No, you don't. You do not want to go to jail for something you did not do.
For a year? Give me a mil. I'll do a year.
Yeah. You're not getting a mil for a year. The people who get millions spent years in prison.
Yeah. The problem is, I want to know what the consequences are for these people that put people behind jail falsely. Normally, it's nothing.
They have no consequences.
So then, yeah, like, they're just trying to get convictions. That's why this is going to be pissing me off.
You are going to get pissed off. According to the Innocence Project, of the 258 DNA exonerations that they have worked, 25% of them have involved a false confession. And in New York City, in the 80s and early 90s, police coercing confessions from teens and young adults was at a record level. We first started learning about false confessions with the Central Park Five case and Making a Murderer with the false confession from Brendan Dassey.
Is that the kid that wanted to watch wrestling?
Yes.
That's all I remember from that. I don't have no clue what happened that, except he went to jail. He said, "Will I be home for WrestleMania?"
Yes, that was him. And he is still in jail.
He is?
Yes.
Did he do it?
No, it was a false confession. Go watch the documentary again. False confessions are real, and they happen a lot. So I have a case today that is going to hit really, really, really close to home. It's a case from right here in the Boogie Down Bronx.
Mm.
This is the wrongful conviction of Hugh Burton. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Raphael and Keziah Burton were born and raised in Jamaica, but the two of them met and fell in love in London. After getting married, they decided to move to America to try to make a better life for their growing family. They moved to New York City and settled in the Wakefield section of the Bronx. This area of the Bronx has a very large Jamaican population, so it was kind of an easier transition for them.
You know what's weird about Jamaicans?
What?
When you go into their restaurants, they never seem like they want to sell you their food.
Like the corner stores?
No, no, no. Like the ones that have like the meals with the rice and the jerk chicken and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I always feel like they don't want to give it to me.
Why?
They don't want to sell it to anyone. I feel like they just like to keep it on display.
Oh, I don't know. I've never noticed that.
And they're never at the counter. Ever. Where are they? You go in, they're in the back, you're staring at the food for a long time. Just give me some oxtails or something.
I love Jamaican food.
And they're stingy with the oxtail juice. You can only get it if you buy oxtail. People ask if like the juice on their rice, like, nope, you didn't buy it.
So this area of the Bronx, the Wakefield section, is a very large Jamaican population. So it was kind of an easier transition for them. Keziah was a nurse, and Raphael was a successful contractor.
Ninja Turtle.
His business was mainly in commercial construction, so he did pretty well for himself. These two were very smart with their money, and they decided to invest in real estate by purchasing a three-family home in the Bronx.
Nice.
Keziah, Raphael, and their son, their only son, Hugh, lived in the second floor, and they rented out the first and third floor units. Keziah, Raphael, and Hugh had a very loving home. Hugh was a good kid. He got good grades. He followed the rules. His parents were typical, strict immigrant parents. And having a teenager in the 80s in the Bronx, it did worry Keziah. But Hugh didn't run with a bad crowd. He didn't do any drugs. There wasn't a lot of fighting in their home. 16-year-old Hugh and his parents got along really well. He was a huge fan of rap, and he started focusing on a lot of music because this is the time when Rakim was out. Like, he was really, the rap scene was huge in the Bronx, and he was...
That's where it was started.
This is 1989. It's like the birth of rap.
Oh, yeah, like that was...
That was the era.
Yeah, I was, I'm not going to tell anyone how old I was, but... I was around.
You were around. And Keziah, you know, she was a little worried because his studies were kind of going on the back burner. He was focusing on writing music. He wanted to be in the recording studios, you know, that kind of stuff. But
then,
all in all.
In early, you know, who knows where you could be. But that was a little too early. Back then, the people that kind of founded rap, they're almost like kind of forgotten about, which is sad. And they didn't reap all the rewards of like, you know, this giant industry now that they kind of created.
Yeah.
But they didn't create the giant industry. They created the music.
Well, she worried about him a little bit, but it wasn't like he was doing anything wrong. He was just focusing on trying to start making music.
And in every generation, when there's new music, parents always think it's like bad.
Yeah.
Like the generation before, you listen to rock and roll, or then the generation before, you had Elvis shaking his hips. Mm-hmm. But he was bad. He had a 14-year-old wife, so he was that was fucked up.
Yeah, I agree.
And then, you know, there was probably a bunch more before that.
So on January 3rd, 1989, Hugh got home from school, and he noticed when he walked in the house that his mother's purse was upside down and emptied out into the middle of the floor. But her car wasn't in front of the home in the driveway, so he thought maybe she stepped out. At this time, Hugh had just started seeing a girl from school. So he and this girl had made plans to meet up after school. Hugh ran in the house, dropped off his book bag, and he was going to meet this girl. He left the house right away. He returned a few hours later and noticed his mom's car still wasn't there. When he walks into the house again, he sees her purse and all her stuff dumped out on the floor, just like earlier.
Yeah.
So now he's like, okay, where is she? This is weird. He starts looking through the house. He walks into his parents' bedroom, and he's faced with a horrific sight. He finds his mother tied to the bed, wearing only a shirt, no pants, and her underwear pulled down to her ankles. There's a knife laying on the bed next to her, and she has two large stab wounds to the neck.
Wow.
Hugh immediately and frantically calls 911.
Police, this is an emergency. I think my mother's been murdered.
Do you know who did this to her?
No, I don't, please.
Okay, thank you.
Police show up on the scene and see Hugh sitting outside on the front stoop. He's just sitting there, staring at the ground, not crying, not talking, just staring, clearly in shock. Unfortunately, however, the cops didn't see it this way. They didn't see a broken young man in shock from a horrible scene that he just walked into. They saw his behavior as too calm, too collected. And to them, it was suspicious.
We spoke about this before, but everyone has different reactions to trauma. And just because someone's not reacting like you doesn't mean they're not experiencing trauma or something like that. I hate that.
I do too.
You know, lately.
Mm-hmm.
They go off Mr. fucking gut feeling over here. Well, look at me talking Mr. Gut feeling.
True, you are.
I am the gut feeling profiler.
You are.
I better shut up.
Well, they saw this as suspicious. So they start asking him questions. And Hugh gives the police a statement, exactly what happened that day. He went to school. He came home for a few minutes. He saw the purse, saw the stuff dumped out on the floor, left to meet up with a girl, and then came home a few hours later and found his mother. Keziah's sister, who lived in Mount Vernon, not far from this part of the Bronx.
Money earning Mount Vernon.
Her sister calls Raphael, because see, Raphael, he was out of the country. He went back to Jamaica to handle some business. He wasn't even in the country at this time. So he gets this horrible phone call that his wife has been murdered, and he immediately hops on the first flight back to New York City. Imagine that flight. I can't even imagine what that poor man went through. Hugh leaves the house and spends the next couple days with his aunt in Mount Vernon. He is unable to sleep. He has no appetite. He's a complete mess because he just can't get the image of his mother's body out of his head. So the next day, police call his aunt's house and they tell her that they need to bring Hugh to the 47th precinct for questioning. They say he is the one that found her body and he was the only one on the scene. So they want to get as many details as they can to help solve her case and find out who did this.
Mm-hmm.
They also want to give him a polygraph.
Oh, no. Come on. Back in the 80s, like they were probably even worse.
Well, Hugh is like, of course.
But it can't be worse. They were always shit and they're still shit. They didn't improve.
Well, Hugh is like, of course, I want to help in my mom's case. He was apprehensive about taking a polygraph, but he's only 16 and he didn't know that that would, you know, be weird or bad for him to do. So he heads over to the precinct at 5 p.m. on January 5th, 2 days after his mother's murder. When he gets there, they bring him to an interrogation room. Three police officers enter the room, Detectives Vigiano, Schiffman, and Jones. And they ask him to tell them what happened. So he repeats the same thing he told them 2 days ago. I went to school. After school, I came home. I saw the purse emptied on the living room floor. I thought it was weird, but I wanted to meet up with this girl. So I just left the house and hung out with her for a couple hours. I came back a few hours later and I found my mother's body.
Seems very believable because when you're a young dude, you're young and horny. You're out of there if there's a girl that wants to meet you.
Yeah, and he didn't think anything weird at the time because he had just gotten home from school. His mom might have been out at the store. He didn't know. He told them this is all he knew, but he said, the car is still missing. So whoever took her car is probably the person you guys should be looking for. He repeated the same story for about 2 hours. They kept asking him for more details, even though he had no more details to give. About 2 hours into the interrogation, cops shift gears and they say, look, Hugh, we know you did this. We know you killed your mother. Immediately, he starts crying. He becomes terrified. He had no idea that anyone would ever think he would kill his mom. This is like something that is just completely insane to him. The interrogation becomes a lot more hostile and confrontational. He keeps saying no. He keeps repeating his story. But now he's terrified. So he asks to see his father. He kept asking for his dad. And police tell him, look, just tell us what we want to hear, and then you'll get to see your father.
Fucking crooks, what we want to hear? How yes. about, like, the right thing to for him to say there is, do you want to hear the truth? You know, is that what you're looking for? Because if not, then, like, get out of my face.
Well, he kept telling them, I'm telling you the truth. This exchange goes on for hours. The officers tell him that they already went to his school to see if he was actually there that day. Hugh's homeroom teacher told police there was no record of him being in class. This is true. The teacher did tell them. So
maybe she didn't take attendance.
Hugh went from being a person of interest to being their prime suspect because of this. He keeps asking for his father. And they keep saying, just tell us what we want to know, and then you can see your father. But he continues to deny it. He continues to deny killing his mom. By 3 a.m., Hugh had been being interrogated for almost 10 hours. He hadn't eaten or drank anything since the morning before. He had asked to see his father and other family members numerous times, but was denied. He's only 16. He's a minor. His father and the rest of the family, they were actually in the precinct downstairs.
Wow.
And they were asking to see Hugh. But the police lied to them and told them that Hugh didn't want to speak to any of them. At this point, the police gave Hugh two options. They said, look, you're going to go to Rikers for not only the murder of your mother, but also this girl that you were seeing, she's 14 and you're 16. And according to New York state law, that is statutory rape.
Is it?
No, they lied to him. And they said, prisoners don't take kindly to rapists in Rikers. Which is a lie. It's not statutory rape. But Hugh didn't know that at the time. And as a kid...
I didn't know either. I just thought maybe I just learned something.
No, as a kid growing up in the Bronx, going to Rikers Island is scary. Especially a kid who grew up not running with a bad crowd, had never interacted negatively with police before, had never been arrested. The idea of him going to Rikers scared the shit out of him.
Not just back then. Going right now is bad. Rikers is terrible.
Definitely. But they said, we have another option for you. You admit to killing your mom because it was an accident. We believe, you know, it probably was an accident. So you can confess to accidentally killing your mother. We will turn your case over to family court and your dad can pick you up in 2 days after you see the judge. And then you and your family, you guys can work it out between you and you can put it all behind you. Hugh says by this point, he weighed his options. He was scared to death to go to Rikers. Option two sounded like the only way out of this room. He was exhausted, hungry, traumatized. All he wanted at that point, after 10 hours, was to get out of this room and see his dad. So there, in the 47th precinct, he made the only decision that he thought he could. He signed a confession saying that he accidentally stabbed his mother to death.
Ugh.
The police fed him a story and told him to say his motive was that he needed money to pay off a drug dealer named Bugs.
Bugs, probably someone else they're trying to get. They have nothing on.
Who he apparently bought crack from. $200. And his mother wouldn't give it to him, so he pulled out a knife to threaten and scare her. But while she was trying to take the knife away, he accidentally stabbed her in the neck. Her car was still missing, so the police asked him where it was, and they coerced him into saying that he gave the car to the drug dealer to settle the debt. Hugh had never done a single drug before. He had never been arrested. His parents taught him to respect police, follow their rules. So this confession was made with the belief that his case would just go to family court and that his dad and him would go home together in like 2 days. The confession used language that didn't sound like a teenager wrote it. The language was very formal. After signing the confession, police told him, okay, now we're going to have to record you saying all of this.
See, that's...
Because back then in the 80s, they didn't record full interrogations. They could turn the camera on whenever they wanted. They probably still do that today. I don't know. But after 10 hours of this interrogation, they finally turned on the camera. When watching the footage of the confession, it looks really rehearsed. I watched it earlier today. It looks really rehearsed, like as if he was almost reading a script. You can also tell that this isn't how he spoke. Like, this isn't how a 16-year-old kid from the Bronx talks. At one point during the recording, he says, "By this time, I was stimulated on drugs." Like, kids don't say that.
I don't say that. Nobody says stimulated on drugs.
And he said it like three times.
Only cops who have never done drugs and tuck their shirts in their jeans when they're not working.
So it doesn't sound like a 16-year-old kid from the Bronx was. He would just say I was high.
If anyone's listening and you're offended that I said that's whack, that means you just need to stop tucking your
shirt in.
Your shirt into your jeans.
Russ the stylist speaks again.
Yeah, don't do that.
So a kid from the Bronx would say I was high. He wouldn't say I was stimulated on drugs. And he says that a few times. And there's other things throughout the confession when he's talking that just sounds too formal for a 16-year-old kid. It made it look really weird. After Hugh reads the confession in full, he's arrested. And he's not sent to family court like he
Rikers,
was told.
Son.
He was charged with second-degree murder. And he was sent to the place he was afraid of most.
At 16, though, I thought they would send you to Spotford.
He was charged as an adult and sent to Rikers.
I mean, Spotford's bad, too, though. Might be worse.
Spotford? Why is it? What is that? Where is it?
It's a children's jail.
Is it far?
It's in the Bronx.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, it's really bad. Mike Tyson was in there and everything.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
It's crazy in there.
That's scary, too. One of the three officers leaked the story to the media. And by the next day, it was everywhere. The headlines went for, like, the maximum shock value. Crack-crazed teen stabs mom to death. All the promises that they made to this kid were lies. And on top of that, they threw his story into the media, and they had a field day with it. Meanwhile, his father, along with the rest of their family, didn't believe this confession. He knew his son would never, ever do this. He knew his son too well. But since Hugh had confessed, it was too late. There was nothing anyone could do to help him at this point. After Hugh was arrested and booked the next morning, on January 7th, the homeroom teacher who originally said he was not present at school, contacted the 47th precinct and recanted her statement.
Wow.
Saying that she confirmed with multiple teachers that Hugh was actually in school that day. She was mistaken. But the police did not take this into account at all, and they kept with their original theory that Hugh killed his mother while he claimed to be in school. On January 11th, 6 days after Hugh was charged, police pull over a car in Mount Vernon for running a stop sign. It was a 1988 gray Honda Accord, and it was registered to Keziah Burton, his mother.
You know, when the cops get these wrongful convictions or these fake, what is it called?
Confessions.
It's messed up that they're not concerned at all that the real killer is still out there.
I know.
Because that person could do it again.
Well, the man driving the car was Emmanuel Green, the first floor tenant to the Burtons.
Oh, shit.
He had just moved in 3 weeks before the murder. He was 22 years old and he was on parole. He had done time a few years before this for a knife point rape. and attempted robbery. He also had previous arrests for assaulting a landlord. Hugh Burton and Emmanuel Green never saw each other. They didn't know each other at all. Hugh was in high school. He was a student. He was up during the day, slept at night. Emmanuel was a bouncer at a club. He slept during the day and worked all night. They saw each other in passing maybe two times. So police bring Emmanuel in for questioning. He's interrogated by the same three officers that interrogated Hugh. After a few hours, Emmanuel goes on videotape to make a statement as well. He said on the morning of the murder, Hugh knocked on his door and told him that he was planning to steal his mom's car. And he said, I quote, "I'll take care of my mother." Emmanuel said he heard arguing and screaming upstairs after this. And he said he overheard Hugh yelling, "You won't give me the money? Fuck you, bitch. I'll just take it."
Of course, he'll say anything.
A few minutes later, Emmanuel says Hugh came back downstairs and confessed to killing his mom. Emmanuel says his criminal mind took over, so he decided to help Hugh in that moment, go upstairs and stage the scene like a robbery, and then he took off with Keziah's car.
That's the stupidest story I ever heard.
Exactly. So after Hugh's arrest, the police kept talking to the media. So when Emmanuel shows up with Keziah's car, these cops, now they've leaked all this shit to the media and they're quoted in the media. They're quoted talking about Hugh. So they can't look like they arrested the wrong kid.
But what I don't realize in life, politicians, policemen, anyone with this fake authority, like you're just a person, fuck your authority.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it not okay to say, oh, damn, I made a mistake, but I could fix it? Or like, not even I could fix it. Like, I just made a mistake.
I know.
Because no one's perfect. You can make a mistake. And I hate all these people with this authority. You have no authority.
Well, like, they do a little bit.
You're just like me. You just took a job that I don't even want to take. But I wouldn't want to be a politician or nothing. I just talk shit, vote for us. I wouldn't even go to work.
But they do have authority because they can ruin your life. They can literally ruin your life in a moment.
There needs to be consequences for stuff like that. You need to face the prison time that the person that you fake, whatever it is.
You wrongfully convicted.
I can't keep think of the word wrongfully convicted.
Yeah.
I was going to say fake convicted.
Yeah, I get it. Well, they needed to make this make sense now because their reputation is on the line. So they had Emmanuel make a statement that would make it all make sense. Hugh's confession 6 days earlier never mentioned Emmanuel at all. In his confession, he didn't talk about talking to Emmanuel Green. He didn't talk about how Emmanuel Green staged the scene or he gave him her car. So now that Emmanuel had the car, the cops needed to make it all link. Months later, Hugh was tried and convicted to the murder of his mother and sentenced to 20 years to life.
Wow.
At his trial, he maintained his innocence and he and his defense attorney fought the confession, claiming it was coerced and Hugh was lied to in order to obtain it. But the judge did not allow any expert witnesses into the trial to try and prove that the techniques being used by cops to obtain a false confession happened in this case.
That's a tricky situation, man, because if someone said they did it, what's more solid than that? And You would also think, like, why would anyone tell them to say they did it if they didn't do it with the huge consequence of doing it?
I know, but and false confessions usually happen. I mean, a lot of times it happens to young people who don't know enough. And it also happens to people who might be disabled in some way. That's happened as well. And it's really sick and scary that, you know, these people are vulnerable people. And when you hear it all play out the way that I explained the 10 hours he was being interrogated and the options he was given as a 16-year-old kid, it makes sense to me that he would choose that option, even though it's not a good option. But if he's told, you'll go to family court, you'll see your dad in 2 days, to him that was the only thing he could do in the moment.
You always just gotta say, kiss my ass.
Yeah, I need a lawyer.
I need a lawyer.
That's it. Well, this jury sees a mild-mannered 16-year-old kid who snapped and killed his mother because he was addicted to crack.
I might have saw it too, man. He said he did it.
At this time in 1989, crack cocaine was an epidemic in New York. This is the perfect way for a jury to wrap their heads around a motive. Crack was a buzzword at the time. The war on drugs was about to begin. So it made sense in the jury's mind.
Which was a huge failure, the war on drugs.
Absolutely was.
That shit didn't work. There's more drugs and more people in jail.
Yeah.
That shit didn't work.
It did not work. You know, this made the jury convict him because that's the perception they had. He confessed. He was on drugs. It all makes sense. He snapped. It doesn't matter if he never went to jail before, had a record. You know what I mean?
I don't think not having a record makes you innocent. A lot of times people think that. Because everyone at one point who's a criminal committed their first crime.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Now, I understand, like, if someone does have a long record, like, oh, well, he is more likely to do this.
Mm-hmm. Like Emmanuel Green.
And he's been convicted for these type of crimes already. And why the fuck is he out of jail if he was knife raping people already?
He did time. He did his time.
Yeah, well,
he was on parole.
Yeah, but how long was he in? He should have did a long time.
I don't know. Emmanuel Green was never charged with a crime relating to the murder, only charged with having possession of a stolen vehicle, but he was never convicted. Now, in Emmanuel Green's statement, he said that he took the murder weapon to hide it. He said this without being told that the knife that was next to Keziah's body was not the murder weapon. This is something only the killer would know.
Oh, shit. Now, if this was another show on TV, we go to commercial. Mm. Ooh, we might even put a commercial in now. You might just be just back from a commercial, suckers.
Emmanuel Green would be stabbed to death a year later over a love triangle, taking the truth of what really happened to Keziah Burton with him.
Oh, we know what happened.
He would never be brought on the stand in Hugh's trial, never able to be cross-examined, never able to be asked the question, how did you know that the knife on the bed wasn't the murder weapon? Hugh spent the next 20 years in prison. He spent this time learning everything he could about his case, false confessions, and the law. He also spent this time in the yard, running. He said in the beginning of his sentence, he would see guys running laps around the yard. And he said these guys looked peaceful and free while they were running.
There's something to running. I always hated running.
Mm-hmm.
And then started running more like some years ago. I don't run as much now, just I'm too busy. But there is, I don't know if this is a runner's high, but there does come a point where your mind is just clear and you're just like cruising.
Exactly. And he said these guys looked peaceful and free. So one day he tried it and he could barely make it two laps.
That's how it goes. And then you always think everyone's full of shit when they say like it gets a little peaceful.
He was determined to get better. So he kept trying and eventually it became his solace. He ran to calm his mind. Ran miles and miles around the perimeter of the prison yard, and he said he was determined to one day run a marathon. By 2009, Hugh was finally released on parole. His father, Raphael...
So he served his whole term.
He served his whole sentence.
Oh, this is bullshit.
His father, sadly, would never see his son a free man. His father visited him religiously every single week. And he looked forward to his visits from his father because that was his like one cheerleader.
Imagine like, you know, how it gives you some hope, like people still care about you.
And just imagine what his father went through. His wife is murdered and his son is convicted for the murder, knowing your son is innocent and he's sent to prison.
That's tough. The father has it just as tough as anyone. Well, not as tough as anyone because he went to jail, the mom died, but he got a raw deal too.
He did.
And his life probably wasn't easy after that.
No. Sadly, just a couple years before Hugh's release, his father was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. He came to see Hugh for one of his visits and thought that he was someone else. After this, Hugh knew he would never see his father again. And
that's
he didn't.
Sad.
But his father was always his biggest supporter. And he knew without a shadow of a doubt that Hugh didn't do this, and he believed that one day he will prove it. Hugh wrote many, many letters to different advocacy groups over the years begging for someone to look at his case. For a long time, the Innocence Project only took on DNA cases. So his case was referred to this awesome attorney named Stephen Drizin at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law's Center for Wrongful Conviction. Whew, that's a mouthful. Because this guy specializes in false confessions. So Stephen started comprising a legal team to conduct their own investigation and try to get Hugh exonerated.
And he's already out, though.
Yeah, he's out, but he's still a felon. So he can't, like...
It's hard to get a job.
Yeah, he can't move on with his life.
I just find that crazy, man. Like, you know, you do your time and you serve however long you serve. But now they kind of force you to still do bad things. You can't even get a job.
Exactly. Yeah. And he had a tough time coming out. I mean, he went in at 16. He got out at like 36.
So he's still young. And you're not rehabilitating anyone in jail. You're just making them worse because they're going to come out and they're going to have to steal to like get food and shit. I mean, you could probably get some bullshit jobs. Well, not really. I know some people that got CDL and truck drivers and stuff. So you could like, there's ways, but you make it really hard.
Yeah, it's hard for them.
I mean, you know, we all think about depending on the criminal. Like, you're like, you don't even deserve a second chance, you motherfucker.
Yeah, but there are a lot of people who do deserve second chances.
Yeah.
There are. A new Bronx district attorney was elected into office, and this gave the Innocence Project and Stephen, his attorney, the perfect opportunity to get fresh eyes on Hugh's case. This new DA actually did a really amazing job. She created a unit in the Bronx called the Conviction Integrity Unit because she noticed a trend of a lot of wrongful convictions happening in the Bronx in the 80s and 90s.
I wonder if you could trace it back to a certain precinct, certain cops that continuously do this or have more of them than others.
I don't know. Well,
I'm never going to look into it that deep because that's a deep rabbit hole, but Jess might.
Well, according to the National Registry of Exonerations, more than 20% of the over 3,000 people who have been exonerated since 1989 pleaded guilty to a crime they didn't commit.
Wait, say that
20% of 3,000 people who have been exonerated since 1989 pleaded guilty to a crime they didn't commit. Which is crazy.
I still have a hard time understanding how people would admit to a crime that they didn't commit, even though it sucks. But I have a hard time getting past that.
I'm sure. But you're also an adult now. Like, at 16, it's tough. It's a tough thing when you're young.
Yeah, you're a lot dumber.
You also just don't know things. And especially if you've never interacted with police before. Like, you don't know that they're lying to you about all this. He didn't know that was a lie.
That's true.
So there's no DNA evidence to prove Hugh was innocent, and they needed to approach this with a lot of circumstantial evidence to prove it. Steve researched the officers who interrogated Hugh and found out that those same three officers had been involved in another case in which a false confession was coerced, and this person was exonerated with DNA evidence. They obtained this false confession just 3 months before Hugh's confession. This man's name is Dennis Koss, and he came to the DA's office to explain how his false confession was obtained. And the officers used similar lies, promises, intimidation. They kept him isolated without food, sleep, or water, exactly like they did to Hugh.
It's kind of like a mild form of torture.
Exactly.
You know, because they're not like beating you, but...
They're fucking with your mind.
Yeah.
It's like mind torture. It's psychological manipulation.
Hit him with your dick. You definitely got to hit him with, all right, I'll tell you who did it. I think it was D. And then you know what's coming after that, right? They're like, oh, who's D? D's nuts.
God.
Definitely got to hit him with a D.
So for the future, everybody, if you're ever arrested for a crime you didn't commit, hit him with the D. His attorneys also presented evidence about the teacher who recanted her statement about Hugh not being in homeroom.
They gotta ask the teacher, what did the cops say to her to make her say that?
Well, I think it was too late for that because this has been 30 years now. But they brought that into this investigation. Emmanuel Green's violent record and how he knew the weapon on the scene was not the murder weapon. It took 10 years of Hugh living as a felon post-release. But finally, the new DA and the Bronx Conviction Integrity Unit agreed that Hugh was innocent and his charges were dismissed.
They better give him money.
He was finally exonerated on January 25th, 2019.
And those cops should go to jail for 20 years each.
They did not go to jail.
They're probably retired, collecting pensions that we pay for our taxes, those fat fucks. I know they're fat. I could see them in my head. And they have bushy mustaches.
No, actually, one of them was a woman, and it was two male cops.
She probably wears t-shirts tucked into her jeans, too.
So that same year, 2019, Hugh ran the New York City Marathon along with his attorney. He said he looked at this marathon as a victory lap around the city that ruined his life. He ran it slow. He wanted to because he said he had run marathons at this point. He, you know, he was released and he was out for 10 years before his exoneration. So he had run marathons already.
Yeah.
But this one meant the most to him because he got to run around this city. And he said he ran it slow. It took him 5 hours, but he was happy to run it slow because he was just taking it all in, finally being free. He also was awarded $11 million because he sued the city of New York.
Good for him. He got a lot of money.
And he awarded it, I think, last year.
Oh, he's balling out of control right now. He's probably in Jamaica recruiting his own Jamaican bobsled team.
Well, he is an amazing person.
Did you get the Cool Runnings reference?
I did. I got it. He's an amazing person, and I watched a ton of footage of him. He actually has spoken out a lot about his case. So I'm going to play some recordings of, you know, his footage, and so that you can hear his voice. He has this like really good spirit. Like you can just feel that he is a good person.
I found my mother that had been murdered, so I called the police, and from there it started an investigation, and I ended up being charged with her crime. As two immigrants who came here from Jamaica, they wanted something. And they eventually got to a point where they were able to save their money and do nice things. They bought themselves a home, only to have it all taken 4 years later. When I think about them and I think about myself, I just say, you know, you have to keep going, you know. When it comes to prison and being in there for long periods of time, the question is not how, you just do. A lot of things that I do now, a lot of things I aspire to do, they were trying to give me when I was much smaller. And sometimes, you know, just having your own ideals for things that you want to do, you know, because when you're 15, you know, you've got the world figured out. So now as a grown man, I see the things that they were trying to show me. Owning something, working hard, you know, sacrificing. And it's now at 46, I'm saying, okay, I get it. So, I get it. I always believed in me that something was gonna happen for me. I didn't know what. I knew at times I would question it. I think anyone in that situation would. Like, is this ever gonna end? Are we ever gonna get to the truth? But there's always that small portion of you, that small piece of you that believes that it'll be corrected.
And that is the wrongful conviction and exoneration of Hugh Burton.
Well, glad you're out, Hugh.
I'm glad he's out too. I would love to speak to him. He sounds so in jail, right? You know how everyone gets nicknames in jail?
Yeah.
His nickname was Wise because everyone said he was wise.
I thought you were going to say because he liked potato chips.
No, because everyone says he's wise.
Oh.
So his nickname is Wise because like all the guys would come to him about legal advice. He hung out in the law library. He studied a lot about cases. And so a lot of guys would come to him for advice. He was very calm. He's a runner. When he speaks, you hear his voice. He's a very calm guy. And
He's probably not even that old now. I mean, maybe
he's 46.
He's only 46?
Yeah, it's been 30 years.
Wow. He's still young and he got 11 mil. He's doing
maybe 47?
He's doing better than me.
He ended up becoming an elevator mechanic. He got into the local one, elevators union.
Oh, that's a good job. But listen, Hugh, you got 11 mil. Quit. Live your life.
Hopefully he quit.
Yeah, like just think of, you know, get the hell out of there. Enjoy your life.
Yeah, go on vacation, bro.
He's probably one of them dudes that got out and he likes having a job and he likes fixing shit.
Yeah.
But
he just got awarded this money last year, so I don't know what he's doing now.
I hope he's in Jamaica.
Yeah, I hope he's chilling on a beach
or wherever
somewhere.
He wants to be.
In a resort somewhere.
Yeah, chilling. All-inclusive, pina coladas,
yeah,
and stuff like that.
Definitely. All right, well, that was our case. I literally, when I watched all the videos of him while I was at work, that's why I texted you, I was tearing up at work watching him talk about his case. Like, my heart broke for him. Also, just watching the type of person he is. He's a good person.
I would have been engulfed with hate and rage. I would have been there thinking, if I ever get out of here, I want some revenge. I wouldn't have been as good as him.
No, I 100% agree. But he, I don't know. I guess when you're put in a position like that, like you have no choice but to serve your time. You're not getting out. What are you going to do? Live with hate in your heart?
And mad
push-ups. Gotta.
Well, you know you're getting out. Some people just have a more positive outlook on life, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a good person. So
shout out to you, Hugh.
Definitely. All right, everyone. Well, check us out on Instagram at Wife of Crime Pod.
And at wifeofcrime.com, we got the cool ass t-shirts and cups and stuff. And there's other stuff, blankets and
yeah,
pillows.
More to come.
That you can hit your kid in the head with if you feel like
a
it.
A pillow?
Yeah, because you can't really slap the shit out them no more. But if you hit them with a pillow, what they gonna say? But they can't claim abuse. My mom hit me with a pillow. They're like, shut up, you little punk.
God. All right, well, we will catch you guys next time.